This is Art Moves, a series of curated conversations at the dynamic intersection of art, innovation, and social justice. Each week, we'll be talking to the visionary thinkers and doers who are forging new ground in the creative arts while redefining what it means to be creative. I'm Tony Williams.
And I'm Eli Kaslansky, and we're your hosts for Art Moves.
Eli, we have a wonderful guest today. We are honored to have Kendall Henry. He is Assistant Commissioner of Public Art at New York City's Department of Cultural Affairs.
And an artist in his own right.
There you go. And a cultural strategist and engineer. And we're going to unpack that. Kendall has played a pivotal role in shaping the intersection of art, culture, and community engagement. From his innovative public art installations to his advocacy for the transformative power of art in public spaces. Join us as we delve into the world of public art and explore the profound impact it has on shaping our cities and communities. That Welcome, like, Kendall. See, he's interrupting me. Go ahead.
The way you said it sounds like a science fiction show.
Some of it is science fiction.
Hey, those are his ears.
Step into the world.
To our listeners, those are his ears.
Look, I think where we should start in a good place is your definition of public art, because I'm sure everybody has their own story about what it is and not, and love and hate of it.
And that always stumps everybody. There's many definitions, which is fine. And at its core, public art is just exactly what the word says. It's art in the public environment. But for us, you know, practitioners of the field, we like to divide it into two categories. Well, many categories, but two main categories. One we call art in public place. And public art. And art in public place is just that. You have going back, a lot of people don't end up going to museums and galleries for many different reasons, intimidation, cost. And so the idea of taking those works and bringing it out into the public environment, that now exposes them to that fine art, that fine work. So when we say public art, art in public place, we mean something very specific, and that's what it is. But when delving into our definition of public art that we use all the time.
Who's the public?
That's part of that too, exactly. That's you're getting all complicated here now. Then we add a little bit more information to that definition. And for us, when we say public art, we mean site-specific. It has a very particular audience in mind. It has a task that it has to perform. So before creating the work, we ask the question, what is this art meant to do? And then in that creation, you have three components that come together equally. That is the artist or the artwork that's going to be created, the community that is being served by that artwork, and the space. And so each one of these things is equal within that definition. And when we say public art, that's what we mean.
So it's not just, so part of the definitions, well, there's a couple other definitions too. One, which, if I may jump in here for a second, one is that it's not just art placed in a place arbitrarily, just stuck there like, you know, somewhere. But I think there's another definition I heard you say in one of your interviews, that the difference between permanent and temporary. That's another.
Yeah, that's another part of the definition as well.
Okay. Yeah.
So, and there's nothing wrong with plopping art, you know, from a museum into a space.
Yeah.
That's fine. That's fantastic, actually, because again, we don't get to go to the museum, most of us. But when we think about the audience, when we think about the space, when we think about all these different, the history and many different things that make it site-specific, and that's a word we use all the time, site specificity, it becomes very special with that space and that time. And so if you remove that work from that space, then it will no longer make sense because it's made specifically for that location. And we thrive for that to, when we do that, we thrive for that to happen in any project, permanent or temporary. And the difference between permanent and temporary is, again, different definitions.
Right.
The city's definition of temporary is anything less than a year, and permanent is anything after that. And it's very different processes to create those works.
Yeah, it's important to make these distinctions because a lot of people don't know them. So,
Now, when you define what you do, you speak about, of course, public art, but you also speak about yourself as a cultural engineer.
Mm-hmm. And strategist.
Explain, and did he, is strategist in there?
Cultural strategist.
Okay, all right, there you go. What does that mean specifically? Or maybe you can't be specific about it. Maybe it's a collage. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a collage because the definition changes depending on the need of the work.
Mm-hmm.
And so this artwork doesn't exist in a vacuum. You know, you put it out there in the public. It's not just about that. It's about the environment. It's about the people. It's about the message. And it's about what that does on a a broader level economically and socially, and how people, you know, perceive the work. So all of that together is a bit of engineering, and that's where the word cultural engineering comes in. And the culture is not just art. It's a lot of other things that's associated with that. There's the culture that is one's background, whether it be from race or ethnicity or, you know, religion, whatever. All that makes up a culture in an environment, and you put art within that environment to make it do something within all these factors. That's where the idea of cultural engineering comes in, because it's thinking about all these things to make that work.
So in site-specific public art, who's engaged in that? How does the community actually have a voice? Because I've been in Brooklyn for over 40 years, and nobody ever asked me about anything that's site-specific. Though, but it would be interesting. How do you find
you think
the people?
It's like Jehovah's Witness. They ring your doorbell.
No. But how do you who is it that
process,
you
right?
Yeah. That who are your stakeholders? Who do you see as stakeholders? Whose voices are amplified in this entire process?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and it's not so much about the site specificity. That's mm-hmm. a two-parter, I think.
Okay.
And so when we start with a project, we start with who is there, who are the ones that are going to be interacting with it, whose space is it, does this belong to? And I'm not talking about whose space, city, environment, space, but everybody takes ownership of spaces, whether it's theirs or not, because they live there, they hang out there, they play there. That's considered their space, right? And so we look at who interacts with that space, and we start there and then branch out. Some works are very community oriented, and I'm going to talk about that community word again later mm-hmm. because it's, how do you define that? But it starts there and it branches out. Some subject matters or some of the artwork focuses on those folks, and some of it broadens out even further. So a work that is in Brooklyn may speak to Brooklynites, but it may resonate with anybody in New York City, and because people visit. And people, the way we treat the work for those who live with it versus those who are transient through the work may be a different way of thinking.
Yeah, you talked also about capped conversations. You know, like art is supposed to create some how do you capture it? How do you know, how do you find out what people are actually thinking about the work, say, as they pass it?
I think also I would add to that, what's the process for getting community engagement out? Do you send out emails? Do you go to, like, organizations, or, you know?
Yeah, and mm-hmm. those questions are connected, obviously,
yes.
right?
Mm-hmm.
That's why I asked it.
Yeah. Smart man. So community engagement is a huge, huge part of public art. There are many different ways to do it. A lot of times it's successful. A lot of times it's not successful. It's a trial and error situation. There are some tools that we put into play to make sure that it happens as successfully as it could happen. And most of it is really thinking about people within their space and sort of reaching people within their space. And what I mean by that is, you know, our offices, for example, at Cultural Affairs is in, you know, the municipal district. So if we have a meeting, having people to come there, have to go through security and all that kind of stuff is just very intimidating at, you know, during the day. You know, so we have to, first of all, we meet people in their space. When you meet people in that space, how do they communicate? Not everybody is doing email or maybe it's an accessibility thing or an equity thing. So we need to understand how do people communicate. Maybe there are particular stakeholders that people listen to, like a deacon in a church, or from a guy in the bodega, or somebody we work with a guy in a furniture shop because everybody goes there. You know, so find these people to communicate and get disseminate information from these folks, and that's how we start mm-hmm. Community engagement. And a lot of it is listening. A lot of it has to
you
be listening.
You once said you love listening. And
oh,
I was like,
favorite thing.
Who is that man? Who is he?
That's my favorite thing.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I could, yes. You know, I'm a behind the scenes person. I just love to listen. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of what you hear and what you don't hear could be applied to how you communicate with individuals or how you present something to them.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM. And we're talking to Kendall Henry.
Yeah, it's interesting that you're talking about this idea about community engagement. When something comes to mind is the Eiffel Tower. And the reason it does is because when, as you know, as it first came out, the Parisians hated it. They thought it was an abomination. But in some ways, sometimes you're putting an art, a public art.
People grow with it, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, mm-hmm. sometimes mm-hmm. 50 mm-hmm. years. That sometimes it's not just to placate community, it's also to provoke them too, yes?
Yes, yes.
So could you talk a little bit
does
about
New
that?
Does New York City want to provoke community?
No, they don't want to provoke them, like, to get them pissed off.
Well, I get it. You don't want to, but it does.
You want to point out something, you know, to, yeah, it's poetry.
I understand.
Yeah, and there are many examples of that. You mentioned the Eiffel Tower, you know, and famous buildings like Sydney Opera House. That was another one. And we have a couple of little ones ourselves in New York City.
The High Line,
you know,
right?
The High Line, yeah. You know, another one. And so somewhere within that process, there needs to be a little bit of leap of faith between the public and the entity that's producing the work. But to avoid, we try to avoid that as much as possible. And to try to avoid that, we do the community engagement component. Our whole process is very open, and we do it in a way that people could come and participate. But there's always those folks who can't come, who didn't know about it until later, and or who just, you know, don't like it. You know, can't please everybody. So the idea of when you put it out there and you know, engage people as much as possible, but really focusing on that community that I spoke about earlier, because they are the ones that have to live with it. And outside of that, you're not living with it. So, and see what happens, but not to be very reactive. So for example, if folks were like, oh, we don't like that Eiffel Tower, take it down, and they took it down, what would happen now? So it's important to engage in conversation about why this is problematic and really listen and sort of have that back and forth, but not remove it immediately, but live with it for a little bit. Maybe your perspective might change about the work. Maybe you get more information about it that you hadn't thought of. And so allow for that time to happen to sit with the work and see what happens.
I'd like to talk to you about some of the programs that you run in DCLA that I'm not sure are lifted up. I'm thinking about your art in public schools, you know? I'm thinking about your Percent for Art program. Let's start with the Percent for Art, because I think that is a law can you talk to us about that?
Yes. So the Percent for Art law is a very typical law in the United States, and a lot of other cities have it. So in 1982, Ed Koch, you know, signed into law the Percent for Art law, which basically says 1% of any capital construction project must 1% must go to the commissioning of a permanent work of art, which means this work of art will be part of that building, park, facility for its eternity, right? And so that's administered through our program.
Is there a size limitation, like it's above a certain level of?
Yeah, so you're getting into a complicated thing.
He likes to go inside baseball.
There is. So it's not a real 1% for the most part, for example.
That's why it's important. Because it's usually large capital projects.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. So it's 1% of the first 50 million.
Okay, there it is.
And half a percent
See?
Okay, he knows
but not limited to 900,000. So for a big billion-dollar project, we may do a $900,000 project, for example, because of the calculation. Right. Schools is somewhat slightly different. The School Construction Authority is a state agency, and so they're not the law doesn't really apply to them because it's a city law. But we work with the Public Art for Public Schools program, which is part of the School Construction Authority, to commission those works of arts in schools. And the calculations are slightly different. It's not necessarily 1%. It's calculated by the number of seats in that particular extension of school.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so we commission work for them for those as well. Since I'm talking about our programs, I'm going to plug a couple of other ones.
Yeah, I like that Public Arts and Residence. Can you talk about
this is
that?
Fantastic.
Yeah, I want to hear. I think that that's one that sort of people don't always know about. And this is exciting as heck.
When you hear residence, they always think like somebody's sleeping in the offices.
Sometimes. So our PAIR program, our Public Artist in Residency program, is a program where we embed artists in city government with a hope of influencing policy. And this is an idea that started actually in 1977. The first artist in residency we had was Merrill Latimer Euclides in the sanitation department in 1977, and she's still there.
Huh.
She's still there. She's not physically still there, of course, but she's still considered an artist in residence at sanitation. You have artists in unusual places, you know, artists in city agencies that are not agencies. And so artists are creative thinkers, and they are part of really thinking about how that agency could help solve their problems, let's say.
Right.
So that program has been very, very important for us. We could only do about 4 a year.
Can you talk about some positive outcomes with that?
Yes, yes. So the way the residency is structured is like as a two-parter. The first 6 months or so, it's the artist learning about the agency and the agency learning about the artist. So the artist gets access to everything, you know, sitting in meetings, understand who the constituents are, what the role of the agency is. And the second half is really the what we call the implementation phase. They've learned a lot, they came up with some ideas, and now they're kind of implementing it. Some of the projects that we've done in the past, for example, we have an artist, Tanya Bigueras, mm-hmm. you know, who worked with Immigrant Services. And part of that residency, you know, there was this, Immigrant Affairs didn't really trust the constituents, and the constituents didn't really trust Immigrant Affairs, which is very typical. She was able to work with some women in Corona, Queens. This was the focus in that particular residency, to, you know, create this thing called Cycle News with these women, and they were able to disseminate that information to their constituents, to their community. And because the community trusted these women, and the women sort of, the government trusted these women, so they were able to get the information that they needed to survive in the city.
It's a very interesting idea. There's an organization that's the basically European Science and Technology Center Association. That program similar to that, they had a places thing, and what they did is they actually had people from the science centers world be in government to help them on policy about science education. So it's a really powerful model.
Yeah, and a lot of other cities are doing residencies.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
We weren't the first ones. But, you know, a lot of them are adopting the idea of having an artist in city agencies.
I want to talk to you about something that has become very controversial, and that's monuments. Mm. How are you moving forward in the monument space? Because, yeah, I'm sensitive to it, too. You know, I'm not wanting to see Confederate generals on monuments, you know, but we are where we are in this country. So how's that moving here in New York City?
Yeah, luckily we don't have many Confederate monuments.
I know, that's the good thing. hey, we're not down in Virginia.
Yeah,
Virginia.
But the whole monument conversation started with what was happening in the South and the removal of some of these, and so we, like many cities, sort of embraced the idea of really evaluating who was represented in our monuments. And we found out that not many other people were represented besides, you know, white men on horses, pretty much.
Yes.
And so the previous administration started what we call the Monuments Commission, which was both to evaluate it and then see what do you do about it. So a group of commissioners were put together to evaluate and then make recommendations. Within a number of the monuments that we had, we removed one. Which was to J. Marion Sims. I'm air quoting here.
Where is this?
This was on 103rd and Central Park, Fifth Avenue and Central Park. And he was called, quote unquote, the father of gynecology, but he did some horrendous things to women in terms of testing
out.
You know. Nothing. These people.
That was a monument to Goebbels.
big old statue of him. And
right.
So that was removed.
That was amazing.
And then we're in the process of replacing it by commissioning an artist, Vinnie Bagwell, to do that work. And so as part of that evaluation of what wasn't represented, there was no representation, very little representation of women. So another initiative was launched, was She Built NYC, and that's well on the way. Our first one that we're in the process of commissioning was Shirley Chisholm in Prospect Park, southern part of the park. And Amanda Williams and Olalekan Jafus are the ones that are creating the monument for that one. And it's going to be beautiful.
Were you involved in the removal of the Teddy Roosevelt monument in American Museum of Natural History?
That was another monument that was part of the conversation.
Okay, good.
But the museum decided to remove it on their own.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM, and we're talking to Kendall Henry. Now, Kendall, we've done a lot of talking about what you do, but there's other things that you do. You are also an artist, but you're in a world where there's so many conflicts. How are you navigating? How are you getting your art out there?
The easiest way, to not have conflicting a situation because of my job.
I know, because it can be real hamstringing. Yeah, yes,
it's to not do it in New York City.
Ah.
So I don't do anything artistic. Because let me go back. My practice in art is collaboration with other artists and other individuals. So if I collaborate with an artist, then they get a commission. That's really bad. That doesn't look really good. So I leave the country to do my own artwork. And I go to other places, like places where I am at a disadvantage in terms of cultural knowledge on purpose. So I go to foreign countries like Russia or Central Asia or, you know, some Caribbean to practice my
Believe you did something with water.
Yeah, I was going
to
ask about that.
Yeah, can you talk to us about that?
That's a great project.
I was wondering how, I want to see the connection to art like and water.
You want to say like how it started?
Yes, exactly.
That was a great project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so... this project was in, Dushanbe in Tajikistan. Mm-hmm. And I spent about a month in Dushanbe. And again, my practice is I have conversation. I speak and listen first to people who live in that community. And in terms of when we were having a conversation, the conversation came around what do we have access to and what we don't have access to. And if you know anything about Dushanbe, it's 90% mountains, which means the city's in the valley, which means all the water comes into the city, but people don't have access to it. Mm-hmm. And that was an issue. So we decided to do a number of projects around water or the lack of access to water. We did 25 different projects, and that started conversations. All the projects were meant to start conversations about the issue. So I'm just giving you a couple of examples. One was we canned water. And in that particular part of the world, people don't use canned goods. So it was a bit of a fantastical thing to have goods in can, particularly water, and we gave it away for free. But if you don't use cans, you don't know how to access the stuff in the can. So it was a challenge to open the can to access the water. And as that's what's happening, we engage a conversation about access. So again, each artwork was a catalyst for further conversations. Another project was we had people sample water from different parts of the world.
Oh, yeah, this is one of my favorites. Yeah, I love this one.
Yeah, and so we'd set up in the market, where, again, everybody hangs out, and we'd say, come and taste water from different parts of the world. You have American water, you have local Tajik water, you have European water, Australian water, and we'd ask them which water tastes the best. And everybody had a different, better tasting water, but everybody thought the worst tasting water was their local water. And at the end of that, we said, oh, by the way, all the water is the same. And so really engaging in conversation about why is the grass greener on the other side when, you know, what you have is less than.
I was so confounded by that because in my mind, is there a visual representation? Is there going to be music to this? I mean, that's kind of how I was thinking about art.
How the other aspect is,
yeah, like, you know, so it was, it lost me in a way, you know, to make that connection. Like so artists are driving conversations.
Are you asking also set 10 different water bottles?
Yeah, I was just wondering.
How'd that work?
And again, this is probably my limitation around seeing art and how I experience it. But I was waiting for paintings and things, you know?
Yeah.
No, seriously.
No.
You know? Yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah, and so that type of social engaged practice in art doesn't look like your typical type of art. So it may or may not be a painting. It may be an interaction.
Interesting.
It may be like a conversation, actually. It may be something that is led by an artist to, again, going back to the what is this art meant to do kind of question in the beginning when it comes to public art. And then, you know, how do you get that answer? It doesn't necessarily mean a physical, sculptural painting thing. It could be an activity.
I think that's so the work that I did for the past 30 years at Con Ed, where I was engaging with community, I was doing artwork.
Perhaps.
Yeah, I was doing it. Yes, I was. But anyway.
The next thing I was thinking about to ask you is this idea about the rise of digital and interactive technology, and like, you know, how do you see that influencing the future of art? Do you start seeing a lot of artwork where people are starting to embed this in it, and how do you think that could manifest?
Mm-hmm.
It's a multi-part question.
Yeah, but I embrace that for a number of reasons. A lot of times when you see an artwork out in the public, you see the end result of a lot of conversation, a lot of interaction, a lot of engagement, and that's sort of the artifact. That becomes the artifact of all that. And sometimes the piece itself, there's so much more information that you could get that you just cannot get from visually observing it in its present state. So I think incorporating digital technology from a simple QR code situation or any other forms of, you know, VR or, you know, all that kind of stuff to see it in a different level is just enhances it quite a bit. Now, the idea of creating digital work in public art in and of itself is great, but it's sort of like sometimes it's an equity thing, because not everybody has access to the technology to sort of relay the information that you're experiencing. So it's sort of a give and take, but on a whole, I embrace it as much as possible.
Yeah, that made me think, you know, one of the things I do in my other life, which is like, you know, my evil twin, but I'm a partner in one of the leading interactive multimedia companies. Do a lot of work with large scale museums, digital artwork in public places. And there's this concept that made me think that would be beneficial called omni-channel experiences. Mm-hmm. So they exist simultaneously on a location, physical location, but also online. So it seems that could be a promising area for public art, no?
Yeah. Because a lot of times we just don't have, there's so much to get from a work that you just can't get it from the physical piece.
And I think that will also help with the community engagement too, because it's the first read oftentimes is off.
You know, there's also this old adage that you need one to get one. So concerning your first public art project, how would an artist get started who's never done one before? How do you get in? How do you penetrate?
Mm-hmm. So for us, we're very aware of that, right? And so our process is such that you don't have to know anything about public art to get one of our projects. So I would say about 85 to 90% of the artists who've done work with us, this is their first project.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because we know many different organizations, they need to see what you can do versus before giving you a whole bunch of money to do it. And so we make sure that that's not an issue. So I would suggest try to get one of our projects. Mm-hmm. But other than that too, it's just experiment with some ideas. Experiment with just putting something outside of your studio and see how people interact with it, see how it's interpreted from what the idea you had in your mind to what people think, just as a thought. This sort of gives you a lot of information to tap into doing a public artwork. And for those who have done proposals, make that proposal part of your portfolio, because people are now, we who look at public art, see how you think about public space along with your regular studio work.
That's
valuable information for us.
Now you also have a public art registry?
Oh, the registry,
yeah.
Right.
Talk a little bit about that.
So we have a registry at Cultural Affairs, and if you want to tap into it, I think that it's percent@culture.nyc.gov, and it's where the first place we look at when we're considering artists for any project. It's not
really
the only place we look at, but mm-hmm. it's the first place we look at.
So that's really important. Any artist who wants to be involved in public art needs to do that as a first step in a way, yes?
Yes. Okay. Again, you don't have to have any experience.
Yeah, thanks.
And does it not involve you in all aspects of what's going on in DCLA? I'm thinking about you have the city canvas, you have all these other programs.
Yes.
That could be like an entree
to other programs.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, every one of those programs, exactly.
Interesting.
Excellent.
That's really good to know. So we unfortunately have to wrap up because we could probably go on another 17 hours here. So first I want to thank you so much for coming here. I think you gave some amazing insights about the world of public art and also your role as an artist, which I think find fascinating.
To all our listeners, thank you for tuning in. For more information, visit us at artmoves.net. That's artmoves with a Z. You can also listen to us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Art Moves is co-produced with Brick Arts Media and recorded at Brick Studio in downtown Brooklyn. This has been Art Moves with your host, Tony Williams.
And Eli Kislansky. Find some art that moves you and share it.